We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 16th.
We should vote on some stuff.
Representative Simonson moves approval of the minutes dated March 11th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The members, what we're going to do here is we're going to have Representative Anzels do a brief presentation of his bill. And then we're going to hear, as part of that bill, we're going to have a discussion on energy-intensive industries and energy affordability for that area. I see that we have many, many testifiers. The chair's intent is that this portion of our bill, our hearing, will last from now until about 1:45 to 1:55, sometime in that range. And then that conversation will be over, and we'll move on to the overview from the Department of Commerce. I do want to make sure we give ample time for their presentation as well. So that's what the chair's intent is. Representative Metz, I think you might want to make a motion on House File 1782. Is that correct?
Are we laying it over for possible inclusion?
We are.
That's the motion I'd make for 1782 then.
Representative Metz moves that House File 1782 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Anzels.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for giving the stakeholders as much time as you've devoted to this legislation, because this bill is the product of countless hours of discussion and brainstorming and work on behalf of many, many industries and utilities. And I want to personally, Mr. Chair, thank you once again for hearing the bill. And hopefully at the conclusion of this hearing, we will all be more clearly understanding the importance of it, the necessity of it, because it is directly tied to the future of the economic condition of all of Minnesota, and in particular northeastern Minnesota. The bill, as you know, outlines a process. It's a process for defining and determining suitable electric energy rates for a number of industries which are natural resource based, which are globally impacted by trade policies and worldwide economics, and are industries which are energy intense. My second point has to do specifically with northeastern Minnesota. As you know, we are a natural resource-based economy. We have timber, we have forest products, we have mining, and we have tourism. And so clearly, two-thirds of our economic condition is dependent upon affordable energy, affordable policies that make our natural resource-based products competitive in the global market. And that, frankly, is the genesis of this legislation, competitiveness. Competitiveness with other producers in other parts of the world of these natural resource-based products. And I'm sure the stakeholders that are here today, many of whom traveled 4 and 5 hours to get here, will share with you their experiences and their expertise about why this bill is so necessary. And again, I want to emphasize that this bill outlines a process to get us where we want to be in terms of energy competitiveness. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I just want to tell you one very short story. It was in November 2011, and an iron ore mine had opened. And as is the tradition that the Finns taught the rest of us, the first ore car shipment of that iron ore contained a pine tree stuck in the top of the ore car. And that was something that the Finns taught the rest of us about their culture and their hopes and dreams for the Mesabi. That pine tree would signify prosperity, longevity, and hope for future generations of miners. Because it was the Finn who was the first logger and the first miner. And they taught us their culture. And unfortunately, after having been at that event to watch that first ore car of concentrate being shipped, I really did think that finally we were going to have long-term prosperity, long-term hope, long-term hope for young families to come back to the iron ore formation, to begin families, to have families, to educate kids, to buy homes, to have the quality of life that most of you have and most of you enjoy. Well, that didn't happen. That long-term hope, that long-term potential for growth has taken a setback, and you all know about that setback. Energy is part of what we as a state can control in order to get that industry and other energy-intensive industries back on track so that the potential in the eyes of the old Finn with his pine tree on top of the ore car could be realized. So I respectfully ask you to listen to our testifiers, pay attention to the discussion, and hopefully you'll see it in your hearts, Mr. Chair, to include this legislation in your omnibus bill. So with that, if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them, or as you wish.
Representative Manziel, I think we do have quite a few testifiers, and we do have a limited amount of time, so what I'm going to do is try to cycle through as many of the testifiers as we can, and then if time allows, we'll try to go to members' questions, if that's okay.
Okay.
So the first person I have on the list is Pat Mullen from Minnesota Power. What's wrong, Representative Wiggins?
Well, it seems to me it would be good if we could ask questions specifically about the bill and how it would be interpreted, so when we're listening to the testimony, we will be doing it with the right language in mind.
Sure. And Representative Wiggins, I guess the chair's intent, as it has been all session, is that when we have people who have come here from whether short distance or long distance, we want to hear from them first. We can analyze and ask questions anytime. We're gonna be here. So I'm going to put a priority on hearing testimony as we have all session. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you. Chairman Garofalo, committee members, my name is Pat Mullen. I'm Vice President of Marketing and Corporate Communications for Minnesota Power in Duluth, Minnesota. And what I have, I'm going to just be using, hopefully you all have a copy of this graph in your package. So if I could ask to reference that. Should have our logo Minnesota Power on the left, and it's our average large power price for 2005 through 2019. So using that as a guide, what I want to show is how our prices have gone up since 2005. And what you'll notice on the graph is that I've got two percentages on there, one in blue and one in red, above each bar. And the blue is just how much increase it is 1 year over the next.
Yeah, just the test fire. It's in black and white.
Oh, yours is black and white. Okay, well, that's okay. Let's just say that so you should have two numbers above each bar. Mm-hmm. The top number is the increase above the previous year. So what's the percent increase on the annual increase? And then the number below it is just an accumulated increase that we have over time. Does anybody need another copy? Sounds okay.
What's up?
All right. I was just making sure y'all had a copy.
Yep,
we got it. Okay, so what I'm trying to show here is just how much our increase has. Now, why has Minnesota Power incurred these increases over the year? I included at the bottom the major CapEx products that we've done, the projects that we've done over time, and they're really all due to just either state or federal legislation from the Minnesota Mercury Reduction Act, the Renewable Energy Standard, the Transmission Investment CapEx 2020, and ongoing investment has added about $2 billion of investment that we've made just since 2005 to create a graph that shows the significantly large increase in power prices that we have each year. What this graph represents are just those customers that are large power customers, and for us at our company, that's a class of customers that includes just those energy-intensive customers that use over 10 megawatts each year or as part of their power supply. So this is how their pricing scheme looks, and these projects have been done cost-effectively with Minnesota Public Utility Commission oversight and approval. And the benefit of these projects is for everyone, and yet our large power customers pay a disproportionately large share of them. And so going back to...
Sorry, Mr. No, we have please. A wireless device that must be close to one of the microphones if someone can... And just like that, it stops. It's magic.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue with your testimony.
I was just going to say that the benefit of these projects really is for everyone, for all of our customers, and yet the large power class subsidizes the others and pays a disproportionately large amount of these increases. That has really put them in a competitive disadvantage as time has gone on. Maybe in a long ago time when our cost base was lower, it was more appropriate, but in this period where we've invested so much money to have all of the customers pay for those increases is what we're feeling is more appropriate for these customers to be competitive and employ the thousands of jobs that they do in our region. That's pretty much the end of my testimony, unless you're...
We'll wait till questions later. At the end, Representative right. Wiggins. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Next we have Mr. Brandt and then Mr. Gerber. And if you're on deck, if you could just be kind of ready. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries. MFI's members do a variety of things. They're paper mills, sawmills, engineered wood products manufacturers, forest landowners, producers of utility poles, pallet manufacturers, and producers of renewable electricity from forest biomass. The forest products in industry in Minnesota employs about 31,000 people statewide, pays $1.5 billion in wages, and produces products of a direct value of $8.5 billion, and when indirect and induced economic activity is added in, it's a total impact to the state of $15.7 billion a year. Each paper mill job produces four jobs within the state outside of the paper mill. So it's that segment of the industry is something that is a very large job generator for the entire state. We pay about $446 million in state and local taxes and pay the DNR and the counties another $32 million a year for the wood that we harvest on public lands. We are the fifth largest manufacturing sector in the state, although we used to be the second largest, and I will get back to that in a minute. I do have a handout. If something can... go, which I will refer to, and there's just three slides. I mean, I got lots of slides, but three in the handout. The first shows the manufacturing costs of producing paper. You will see that roughly 25% of the cost of manufacturing a ton of paper is in wood, about 25% is in labor, about 25% is in energy, primarily electricity, and the balance in purchased materials in services. So the cost of electricity is a very, very significant component in us manufacturing our products. If you look at the second slide, it's a slide that was first developed during a report done by the Pawlenty administration on the competitiveness of my industry. That report back in 2003 showed that there were only two areas where we had an advantage over other competing states and jurisdictions, and that was one of those was in electrical costs. The other was in productivity of our workforce. As you can see on that second graph, that advantage has been lost. There's a suite of states that are timber-producing, paper, wood-producing states that we looked at. You can make a similar comparison with other states, but the graph gets a little busy the more you add to it.
Mr. Brandt, what's the dotted line?
The dotted line would be The U.S. average.
Okay.
Dotted red line, U.S. average. The final slide shows the increases versus other states that we're looking at. You can see that 41 states have had smaller increases than we have since 2002, and that using 2002 as the base, there's over a 70% cost increase. As I said, we had been the second largest manufacturing industry. We're now the fifth. The reason for that is we have lost one-third of the primary forest products industry in Minnesota over the last 9 years. 1 year, one-third. That includes four oriented strand board plants, one paper mill, and four paper machines in mills that continue to operate. By way of example, if we look at the now permanently closed and torn down paper mill in Sartell, that paper mill had 14 different electrical rates depending upon when and how it was running. They were on interruptible power, so when the XL system's load got too high, they had to shut down. It's not really simple to shut down a paper mill and then restart it, and it's certainly not a path forward to having a competitive mill if you're stopping and starting during the summer months. As they got into the final years of the operation of that plant before its permanent closure, in order to reduce electrical costs, they ran their pulp mill at night only. So everybody was working nights in the that was in the pulp mill. You know, there have been bills in the past on cost-based rates. This bill is not a cost-based rates bill. For those of you that aren't familiar with that, essentially, as Mr. Mullen mentioned, industrials subsidize everybody else's power. I live in Duluth on the Minnesota Power System. I don't need to have my electrical rates, my electrical bills subsidized. We as an industry don't have any problem with the system taking care of poor people. That's not something that we have a concern about. But this is not a cost-based bill. As Representative Anzell said, it establishes a process through the PUC to address the competitiveness of large power-using industries like mine. I'll just tell you one other little story. I mentioned the Pawlenty report. This is an update from last year of that competitiveness report. There's been several others. During the deliberations of that task force, I had several of the plant managers from my industry that said they were not in a position, because they like their jobs, to recommend to their bosses that they invest in the plants in Minnesota. That Minnesota was not competitive, that one of the significant reasons was the electrical costs. That's something that is I've never heard any of my members say before, and that is of great concern. I'm not going to tell you that's all a result of electrical costs, but electrical costs are a big chunk of what it is. My industry has to have competitive rates. We have to have competitive power costs. This bill is a path forward to doing that. We need to see it pass now. And I was going to say otherwise it will shrink, our industry will likely shrink further. That's a little bit too much of a euphemism. If we don't get this resolved and resolved soon, I believe that we will see further loss of mills and machines and jobs in my industry. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Mr. Brandt, very quickly, just because you brought it up, I think it's important that members of the committee understand the difference between the EITE and the cost-based rates proposals. Just at a very minimal, can you just explain to members that these are not the exact same thing? The chatter in the hallway has been, excuse me, I got a Twix in my mouth.
That's okay, Mr. Chairman. These are significantly different. The cost-based bill proposals essentially dictated to the Public Utilities Commission what they were going to do on this topic and how they were going to do it. Representative Anzell's bill does not do this. It sets up a process for negotiation of rates, presentation of them to the Public Utilities Commission, Public Utilities Commission review, and necessary findings that such rates would be in the interest of the state and others going forward. So the Public Utilities Commission would be intimately involved in anything that got done, any rates that were approved, or anything of that nature.
Thank
That's
you,
the difference.
Next, Mr. Gerber, and then Mr. David Lilligard?
Leslegard.
And I would just, Mr. Gerber, and to all our testifiers, again, I have this committee slated, this portion of our committee slated for about 40 to 45 minutes, so If you've heard someone make your point, just get to the point, be brief, and we'll move. Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I wanted to testify in support of this bill. The Minnesota Chamber, and on behalf of our 2,300 members, we believe this is the right way to fix energy competitiveness issues. We are modernizing our regulatory system. I think we discussed it before, but we are operating under a system that was created almost 100 years ago, and it's really inflexible. This bill will introduce flexibility. It will allow things like clean energy rates, market rates, and fixed rates. These are things that our surrounding neighbors are doing. There's a reason why Google and Facebook invested billions. It was over $2 billion in Iowa because they were able to do these. They had the flexibility in their regulatory system to do these types of things. I also want to mention that it's important the PUC has multiple bites at the apple. This isn't something that's automatically approved. There is still a pretty strict regulatory regime in place where the commission can review and make sure that this is in the best interests of customers. And this also isn't something new. Municipal utilities, cooperatives, they all do this. They're able to. There's a reason why most of the data centers in Minnesota have gone to municipal or cooperatives, because they can negotiate these types of rates. I think finally, what we want to say here is that that this is important for our members because we are losing competitiveness. As you've heard, we've dropped to 31st in terms of industrial rates. We're continuing to lose our competitiveness. And this applies as well, not just to large customers. You're going to hear it from a lot of large customers. This is about energy intensity. So if you're a small manufacturer and the cost of a large cost of doing business is energy, you will also be able to apply through the commission. And this is what's frustrating. The current the competitive rate rider that we have now, you have to go into the commission and basically say, we are going to leave the state unless we get this. That's a little overgeneralizing, but it's almost to that point. And so why would we want to, as a policy, tell our businesses that they basically have to go and say, we're going to leave unless you give us a different rate? This allows the flexibility. This doesn't force our businesses to look at other options. It keeps them here and keeps them happy in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Next up, Mr. Melander's on deck after this. I agreed to have Mr. Melander testify in my committee. This is outrageous. I was kidding, Harry. I don't see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Dave Lisliger, and I'm a councilman for the city of Aurora. I also work for Lakehead Constructors, a supplier vendor to large heavy industrial companies across northeast Minnesota and Wisconsin. Lakehead has been in existence for nearly 100 years. We employ several hundred men and women who live and work on the Iron Range, all who depend on mining as a way of life. And we are only one of many vendors who provide high-quality jobs to thousands of men and women because we serve Minnesota's large industry. We understand the challenges facing our region. We also understand that mining, in particular, the lifeblood of our region, is currently being threatened on many different fronts. Power costs are clearly part of that threat, burdening mining ability and threatening our ability for jobs. As a city official and a former steel worker from the East Range who lost his job due to a plant closure, I know firsthand the fear and uncertainty these families and communities are facing as mines shut down in the face of global competition. It's a terrible feeling, but it is real, and it is now. Lakehead stands united with our industries and our communities as a region. We respectfully ask that you please support Energy Competitiveness Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Melander, and then Lori Fado is next. And Mr. Melander, it's always a privilege to have you before this committee. I was
okay.
Only kidding.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm here on behalf of 60,000-plus construction workers throughout the state of Minnesota that are back to work because of the good work that you've done over the last 4 years, and I always think it's important that we say thank you. But this, too, will pass. We think this bill is very important, not only for the northeastern part of Minnesota, but throughout the state of Minnesota. People that work within the construction industry are benefactors of industry, not only when we have the opportunities to build new facilities, which we constantly encourage, but also in the jobs, the thousands of jobs that are created annually in maintaining those facilities. Competitiveness is very important We no longer are competing regionally but globally, and we would hope that you would move this bill forward so that we continue to have options in the state of Minnesota, so that we continue a strong economy and provide opportunities for those industries and also for the people within the construction industry. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melender. Ms. Fado, and then Mr. Chirati, I believe, is after that. I apologize for the names if I'm butchering them. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Lori Fido, and I'm president of the Hibbing Area Chamber of Commerce, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for inviting me to speak today and allowing me to speak. I want to thank Representative Anzels for bringing up the fin and the pine tree, because I grew up in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in a mining community that lost all of its mines, and they lost their mines because they were no longer competitive, cost competitive. And where did they go? Where did all our Finnish people go? They came to the Iron Range of Minnesota. You have heard of the loss of 450 jobs to the Central Iron Range due to the idling of Magnetations Plant 1 in Keewatin Taconite. We also lost the Keetac expansion, which was planned and would have added 70 jobs as well as $300 million in investment to our area. As you can imagine, this dramatically impacted our economy. There is not a single person in our area who will not be impacted by the loss of these jobs, and in some way or another, whether they are a mining supplier, a teacher, a chamber director like me, a nurse, or a merchant. We would be fooling ourselves if we did not agree that this will have a long-reaching effect across the entire state of Minnesota. For the last few years, our state has been piling on regulations and costs as if they do not matter to these industries and the jobs they bring. We are getting hammered by a lack of competitive rail, expensive standards and regulations, permitting costs and delays, just to name a few things. But they do matter in an era where the world is our competitor. If we are to have any sort of industry left in northern Minnesota, and perhaps all of Minnesota, our state needs to be more cost competitive, and it can start today by furthering this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chirati, and then on deck is Mayor King from Keewatin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Roger Turati. I'm the general manager of Gerdau St. Paul Mill. Okay, I'm here to speak about, to see if we can get your support for this bill. I'm going to just give you a little bit of introduction about what Gerdau is. So Gerdau is a global company with more than 45,000 employees in 14 different countries, and we have a capacity of 25 million tons of steel. We are the 14th largest steel producer in the world, and we have 114 years already in business. We are the leaders in the long steel production in the Americas as well. Here you can see where our businesses are. We have a business unit in India, Spain, but majority of that is in Brazil and United States. In United States, we call Gerdau Long Steel North America, and we have 130 locations. Some highlights about Gerdau Long Steel North America. We have a capacity of 11 million tons of steel. We employ 9,500 people, and our annual property tax is around $20 million. Here you can see where the mills are distributed, 14 different mills, St. Paul is right there. And here is it comes to our St. Paul mill, the only Gerdau mill in Minnesota, and is the largest recycler that we have in this state. It's across, alongside Highway 61 and Maxwell Road. Here you can see our process, a very complex process. But there is only one equipment here, which is called the DDC furnace, that is a very, very energy-intensive equipment. You see that we recycle more than 25,000 cars every month, and more than 35,000 tons of scrap as well. And we use this equipment that's called electric arc furnace. It's 75% more efficient than any other equipment making steel from iron ore. This is the principle of the equipment. It's a big electric electrode that goes and allows the current going through the scrap, which melts it. And one data that is interesting, this equipment consumes 35,000 kilowatt hours in 40 minutes. So it means a consumption of a regular house for 2 years. Every day, we consume 630,000 kilowatts. We are the second largest electrical energy consumption in the state of Minnesota. What we do for our community, we have intense participation in our community through the involvement of our employees and our company. So we have Peyton, Merrick Service Center, Hydro Park Nature and Preserve, and we have support for our troops, donate rebar to Habitat of Humanity, Susan Coleman Breast Cancer Walk, and others. Here is just for you guys to see where some of generation of income that we have. In 2014, we paid around $20 million in electrical bills. We have, in terms of benefits and income, $35 million. And for taxes, we collect $4.5 million on a yearly basis. And of course, our unit here in Minnesota has 337 employees. So what are the concerns that Gerdau in North America has? The first one, of course, is imports. In 2014, we had 44 million tons that came in U.S., and is growing. Where this is coming from? Where they are coming from, countries that practice unfair trades, right?
Yep.
They are coming from countries that have no control of environment, and they have cheap energy and labor.
And, sir, they subsidize their operations as well, don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, if you ask me, Mr. Chairman, is it my concern? I would say it's not my concern because it's far away from me. But my concern is our own sister plants. As you know, we have 14 different steel plants in North America. We are the only one in Minnesota, right? We compete with every single ton that we have to produce. We compete with our own sister plants. So, right now, there are plants that can make the same products that we make. And you can see here, St. Paul has the highest energy price amongst our competitors. And some of them are Gerdau plants. There are some good things that happen, like the competitive market rider, the conservation improvement program, and interruptible rates. Thank you very much. But this is not enough yet. This is not enough. We have one of the highest energy prices that we have in North America. So if you look at what we've been doing as a plant itself, you see here that we basically from 2007, we reduced our energy consumption in about 10%. Lots of technology that we invested there. But at the same time, we had almost 30% of price increase. This needs to be addressed. Of course, the cost drivers for that is multi-year Excel rate increase, volumetric allocation of cost. This is something that we need to change as well. Clean power rule compliance as well. When we put legislations to reduce emissions as well, we have to be careful what we do. As we are the only plant melting steel in Minnesota, right, when we really have to be or follow certain rules that we are trying to implement, actually what we're going to do is expel some business like ours out of state, right? But guess what? When we bring the same products back to the United to Minnesota, we're going to have more emissions because we're going to have trucks, cars, etc., moving our products to Minnesota. And as a summary, right, Gerdau is one of the most efficient recyclers that we have in the United States and Minnesota. We, in generally speaking, we basically recycle around 400,000 tons of scrap and around 250,000 tons of car bodies that we have. Minnesota power rates are presently not competitive, and they're going to be higher in the future, 5% year on year until 2017. To continue to have our business continue in Minnesota, we are competing with states where those plants are located, And our energy is the highest cost that we have in our conversion cost. So policy is to assist the energy intensive and trade exposed industrial customers in achieving these rates are essential. We need your help on that. Gerdau is committed to working with the utilities, legislators, and regulators to really achieve our goal and see if we can keep our business in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You said the arc, how much electricity it uses? It was it 35,000
kilowatts? 35,000 kilowatts hour every 40 minutes.
That's almost as much as my car. I'm just kidding. I have an electric car. It's a joke. Yeah. No, it's a lot of energy.
Yes, it's the second, our plant is the second electricity consumer in the state of Minnesota. And for you guys to have an idea, it's 630 megawatts a month.
Amazing. Megawatt hours.
Megawatt hours a month.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Mr. King, and then Commissioner Grant, you're next.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is William King. I'm the mayor in the small town of Keewatin. I would like to thank Representative Van Zelk and Senator Tomasini for authoring this legislation. Last Thursday morning, I received a phone call from the Keetac plant manager. He wanted to tell me before the press release came out. Excuse me. That U.S. Steel was going to announce the idling of the Keetac plant. I get a little emotional.
Yeah.
Because it will affect our whole city. This was just after the Magna Tation had announced a closing of the Keewatin plant. My first, excuse me, here we go. My first response was, here we go again. In 2009, the Keetac plant was shut down for a year and 400 employees were laid off. These are my friends and neighbors. People from Hibbing, Nashua, Chisholm, Pengilly, Grand Rapids, and the surrounding area. These shutdowns not only affect the plant employees, but also the small business owners in Keewatin and in the communities around us. There's a trickling down effect, and the longer these shutdowns last, the more and more people that lose their jobs. Economic effects can last for years. As a city, this will have a direct impact on our next year's budget and the years following. We have just got past the impacts from the 2009 shutdown. I've lived in Keewatin for 37 years. Excuse me. I worked as a police officer there for 31 years, retired as the police chief. My dad was a 40-year miner. When families and communities struggle economically, it can also lead to social and criminal problems. I thought I'd be able to get through this. I'm sorry. That's why it's so important that we move in the right direction and we help these companies be competitive in a global market. I support House File 1782. Thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Mayor, thanks for your testimony, and more importantly, thank you for caring. Thank you for caring. It matters. Thank you. Commissioner Grant, and then the Mayor of Hibbing. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Chairman Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, and we've worked closely with the proponents of the bill, the Chamber of Commerce, and the large power interveners in particular, and while we're clearly sympathetic to the concerns that this bill is attempting to address, we certainly higher rates for industrial customers, we have a concern for higher rates for all customers. And simply put, if one group of customers gets a lower rate, everyone else pays a higher rate. And the manner in which we go about doing that is obviously quite important. There are clearly instances where offering a lower rate to a customer or a group of customers is in the public interest, and that's why we're anxious to continue working on this. But this bill, in our view, doesn't get that done in a way that preserves the public interest. In addition to shifting cost to non-industrial customers, including at this point low-income customers, the bill also offers the opportunity for large customers to select their own power source, which is, in our view, a step towards deregulating the industry, something that we managed to avoid in Minnesota in the early 2000s, while other states did not and are now suffering with much higher rates and an inability to be selective about the power sources that serve them. The bill doesn't set a floor on how deep the discount offered could be, and this could mean that an industrial customer could have a rate below the incremental cost of serving that customer, again forcing all other customers to pay those costs. We're also concerned that the bill attempts to limit the PUC's discretion in approving an EITE rate with non-permissive language at several points in the bill, which I'd be happy to point out. We have offered alternative language, which in our view would improve the bill dramatically. First, we believe that the bill needs a clear test that an industrial customer would need to meet in order to be eligible for a reduced rate. We would remove the clean energy technology language to avoid the deregulatory aspects of the bill in its current form. We would like to give the PUC full discretion in determining whether a rate discount is in the public interest and otherwise just and reasonable. We would exclude low-income customers from having to pay for any discounts to large customers. And we'd like to assure that the rate discount at least requires the industrial customer to pay the incremental costs of serving that customer. So the department is certainly willing and has been, as I mentioned, to continue working on this bill, and would look forward to any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Commissioner. And if you could, I have not seen that language. If you would feel comfortable sharing it with me, I'll share it with the members of the committee.
I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mayor Cannata?
Cannata.
Cannata. And then on deck is John Hottinger.
Well, first of all, I'd like to, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for letting us be here today to speak in front of you. I'm the mayor of Hibbing, Minnesota, and also I've been a member of Minnesota North Dakota's Labor's Union for over 36 years. Mr. Melander said, you know, it's a twofold situation when these plants are closed down up there. It's the people that work in the plants, and it's the gentlemen and men and women that work on build the plants and maintain the plants on shutdowns. So when you close a plant down because they can't be competitive in the global market, you're not just laying off the people that are working in the plants and their families, you're hurting the construction trade too in northern Minnesota. And as a mayor of Hibbing, Minnesota, I've seen it before. I grew up in this, and the young families, they leave. And then as more and more people leave these small communities, like Mr. King said, you know, in northern Minnesota, Keewatin's 5 miles from Hibbing, Chisholm's 5 miles from Hibbing. We're 15 miles from Nashrock, Minnesota. It affects the whole Iron Range, and not just the people that work there, the people that work in the restaurants, because these are good-paying jobs, and when these people are making the money and it's competitive, they'll go out and spend the money up there. So it's a trickle-down effect to everybody, from the bartender to the waitress that's working, you know, night hours and keeping a job, to the teachers. So I'd just like to thank Representative Anzell for authorizing this bill, and from coming from both sides and seeing this happen, it'll affect many, many people that they can't be competitive in the global market up there, because that's our living up there, our natural resources, from timber to the taconite to everything else that's up there in the land. So I'd just like to say thank you for letting me be here today, and I support Representative Anzell's bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for making the drive. Mr. Hottinger, and then Mayor DiNucci from Nashua.
Hey, Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is John Hottinger. I represent the Sierra Club, and my message is relatively brief. It's one of empathy, and it's one of suggestion. I apologize. I missed the representative's presentation on the bill, but I certainly saw a couple of the emotional witnesses. The Sierra Club did some polling in the range area in the summer of 2013, and some of those findings are important on a broader range. There's popular support for phasing out coal-powered plants. That's not today's discussion. But there's also popular support for clean energy, and clean energy meaning setting standards and setting efficiency, because efficiency helps build valuable savings for consumers and for power companies. I also heard Mr. Grant testify. Mr. Grant's testimony, I think, is one that I hope the authors heed, and I suspect they will, that they continue to work with the Department of Commerce to find some language that makes this otherwise concerning bill more palatable and will actually provide some assistance not only to the power companies and their large users, but maybe the people at the range also, instead of shifting the expenses. After that poll came out, I spent last summer vacationing near Hibbing. Part of it was I was just finding out I might be here to talk on behalf of the Sierra Club, and it had been a while since I'd had my exposure in the range, and it was only a couple of weeks. And
I want you to want me too. I heard that. Sorry.
It was mostly in Hibbing, and frankly, much of it at the library. But I went around to Hibbing and its surrounding communities, and I was just some tourist. I didn't pretend to be anything more than that, and I wasn't. Just kind of talking with people, and it reaffirmed something I learned long ago. These are good people who work very hard in a culture of difficult to find jobs. And I am empathetic to that, and more importantly, the Sierra Club is empathetic to that. So we hope we can find a resolution other than just blaming environmental regulation. We've all seen the newspaper what the root causes are for the problems with the shutdown of the plant, or at least the suspension. And they're much broader than will be solved in this committee room. So, carrying with me the good vibrations I got in Hibbing, I am changing my testimony from suggesting all the problems with it. I think Mr. Grant has pointed that out, to an expression of support for finding an avenue to make this proposal work and work for the people of the range in addition to the mining companies. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hottinger. Mayor DiNucci, and then Ms. Donnelly.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ben DiNucci. I'm the mayor of Nashwauk. I'm a fourth-generation resident of Nashwauk. In addition, I'm a volunteer firefighter there. I'm on the ambulance EMS. I own a small business in Nashwauk, and I also own Keewatin Auto Repair in Keewatin, Minnesota. I live in the heart of the Iron Range, and our lifeblood is providing the iron ore that builds this country and supplies our steel mills. In the past few weeks, my community has become ground zero. I now understand how mayors of communities that have faced floods, tornadoes must feel. Between magnetation and key tax announcements, over 450 people in my area now know that their lives are on hold and that their jobs are at risk because of the challenges facing their companies. Every single citizen of my region is touched by this news. We've been holding our breath since early last year when we began to see the price of iron ore fall through the floor. We've lived through and weathered these times before, but this time it feels different. There are so many things that are piling up on this industry. Just a few weeks ago, I signed a letter that ran in the Star Tribune that warned of the impact on both industry and municipalities if sulfate standards were enforced before we've completed the right research and considered which water bodies grow wild rice. For several For several months, our mining companies couldn't get rail service and were forced to use more expensive and less efficient truck transportation. Just a few years ago, we thought Keetac was going to get a permit to expand its operation. But the length of time it takes to get a permit killed that project. Now we are faced with layoff notices indefinitely. Minnesota Power is here today saying they want to be a part of the solution to lower their large customers' operating expenses. Because all of their big investments in renewable energy and environmental regulation, industrial electrical costs have seen a big spike just when these market prices are going the other way. The mines and other large industry in our region have been subsidizing the price of electricity for everybody else. Sure, that's nice when you're paying your electric bill at home, but I can assure you that when your paycheck is at risk and your family's well-being is being threatened, paying a little more for power seems like a small price to pay to keep the mines going. I respectfully seek your support of the Energy Competitiveness Act to allow utilities and large industrial employers to negotiate electric rates that can keep the doors open. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ms. Donnelly?
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julia Donnelly, and I'm here on behalf of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49, and we represent about 13,000 men and women working in today's construction, transportation, energy, and mining industries. We're here in support of this House file, and we urge this committee to support keeping Minnesota's tradition of innovation and global competitiveness alive. I had more that I wanted to say, but in the interest of time, I would like to keep things brief. But I do just want to address something that a previous testifier had said. 3 weeks ago, I sat in a trailer with 41 miners that had just lost their jobs at Magnetation. I didn't get good vibrations. What I got was loss of hope, uncertainty. Deed was there talking to these people about dislocated worker programs. We have another 400 people that just lost their job at Keetac. I think what we need to do is, instead of wishing and hoping for things to get better, is to vote with our feet and move Minnesota in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Donnelly. Mr. Sutherland or Mr. Masi and Antonio. As a fellow individual whose last name ends in a vowel, I apologize for not pronouncing your name right.
No problem.
Good afternoon, Chairman Garofalo and assembled committee members. If we could get our presentation, that might be helpful for you. My name is Larry Sutherland. I'm the head of United States Steel's Mining Solutions, which comprises the Minntac facility in Mountain Iron, the Keetac facility in Keewatin, and two joint ventures of iron ore we have in the United States. I actually had the unfortunate responsibility of announcing the notice to the Keetac management and union people last Thursday, the temporary idling of that facility, and it is not good news to tell a workforce like that. Chris, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Chris Masciantonio. I'm General Manager of Government Affairs for U.S. Steel out of our Pittsburgh headquarters.
I could tell you a little bit about what we do as United States Steel globally, and we'll talk about Minnesota briefly here as well. United States Steel Corporation, headquartered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is an integrated steel producer with major production operations in U.S. Central Europe, with an annual raw steelmaking capacity of 24.4 million net tons of steel. Our company manufactures a wide range of value-added sheet, steel, tubular, automotive appliance, container, industrial machinery, construction, and oil gas industry products. U.S. Steel's Minnesota ore operations of Minntac and Keetac employ over 1,900 people. These are high-paying, family-sustaining jobs on the Iron Range. Every U.S. steel mining job in Minnesota creates an additional 1.8 jobs in other sectors of our economy. Our annual payroll is over $150 million, just short of $40 million in health care benefits, approximately $31 in pension benefits, an additional $6.4 million to the Steelworkers Pension Trust Fund. Annual local taxes of $43.8 million in 2013, and we do business with over 370 vendors with an annual pay of $612 million. We also provide $55 million a year in school trust land royalty payments, which is 94% of the total contribution of that fund for public education in the state of Minnesota. U.S. Steel Minnesota Ore Operations is the largest private consumer of electricity in the state of Minnesota with 300 megawatts of steady load generated power. Even when you talk about our steel facilities globally, we utilize more electricity at the iron ore mines purchased generated electricity than even our steel facilities utilize. Our energy consumption is enough to power all the homes in Minneapolis or several times the city of Duluth. Minnesota's energy-intensive trade-exposed industries, including mining, paper mills, steel mills, are at a global disadvantage with our electricity rates. Operating margins are down due to higher costs, including energy costs, which account for 25% to 30% of our overall cost of production for iron ore pellets. Continued price increases in energy costs will result in a non-competitive market. Our energy rates at our Minnesota ore operations went up approximately 60 cents per produced ton of taconite from 2014 to 2015. That's a huge increase when you're talking about trying to maintain global competitiveness. If I could preface a statement here, in the Wall Street Journal this morning, you can read that the imports of Chinese steel is up approximately 63% with the strong dollar and, I would suggest, unfairly subsidized steel. Most of those steel companies are state-owned. Their impetus is not weighted around making a profit per ton margin as we do in a democratic nation as we live in. Their state-owned companies are there to employ their people primarily. They're not so concerned about the price as they are about employing their own people. Would you like to talk about anything else?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. Larry mentioned the cost electricity plays in the production of the pellets. Well, at the same time, if you look at the next chart, we wanted to illustrate the projections for iron ore pricing. These are global projections, and you can see this year below $60, which I think is the first time in about 10 years.
Yes.
And if you look at the next chart, you see where we anticipate the cost of electricity for the Minnesota operations. So it doesn't take much to imagine that the difficulty you see when the prices are going down and the costs are going up, that's not a good situation for any company to be in. If you look at the next slide, U.S. Steel operates at about 12 locations. The bar graph illustrates those 12 locations and the price of electricity for each, generally. And you'll see 2014, MinTac and KeyTac were about 33-35% above the lowest cost location. If you go to the next slide, you'll see where we project our cost competitiveness to be from an electricity standpoint. For MinTac and KeyTac going into 2019, and they will be the two highest priced or least competitive facilities when it comes to the price of electricity. So very, very difficult situation for the company and for Larry to deal with, and that's where we're headed. There's no question about it. That's why the legislation is so important.
Thank you,
Larry.
So to protect Minnesota's industrial base, including our taconite base, state law must be amended. The laws must allow utilities and energy-intensive trade-exposed industries to negotiate special rates that reflect the benefits that large industries provide to the state. Competitive rates for energy intensive trade exposed customers must be ensured. Utilities and customers must be given the flexibility to negotiate rates subject to discretionary review and approval by the Minnesota PUC. 2015, and I'll correct this slide as we've done the WARN notice at the Keetac facility, it states it's likely to be a critical year. It is going to be a critical year for the future of mining in the state of Minnesota. Chief among these issues will be the electricity prices, EITE HF 1782. So on behalf of United States Steel, I respectfully request the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Policy Committee support and approve HF 1782. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Testimony. We'll now move on to members' questions. I have three members on the list right now. The first is Representative Wagenius, and Representative Hortman, then Mesa, then Neuberger. I guess we got a fourth one now, so Neuberger. So members, again, I would just, in the interest of time, please get to your questions, keep the points to a minimum. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I have three very short questions, and the first one's for the author. When you talked about, you gave your presentation, you talked about one of your industries was the tourism industry. And I am wondering if on line 1.22, 1.23, that they are would be included in this number 7, or likely to be included, or excluded.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, it would be my hope that they could be included, yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, that's helpful. So we, as we understand where cost might shift. My second question was, when Minnesota Power came up and testified, they talked about the price increases, but we didn't, I don't believe, got a figure of how much of Minnesota's power is in these large intensive users and how much is not. So we're missing a context here.
Mr. Mullen, what percentage of your power comes from large energy-intensive industries?
Our large power customers are just 10 customers that make up about 60% of our revenue in Minnesota Power.
Representative Guinness, last question.
60%, thank you. The one other piece of the puzzle that I was hoping we'd hear some testimony about is the efficiencies that are built into some of these industries. Are you thinking about making one of the criteria for this new rate that we're pretty daggone efficient, that particular industry that is asking for this break has done the best it can do for efficiency?
Representative Anzalos, you want to, or one of you three want to?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sutherland from U.S. Steel would
Mr. Sutherland.
Best answer that question.
Thank you. On an annual basis, we gauge in energy programs to continually improve our energy metrics and our energy footprint. An example I could give you was a more recent project of derrick screen installations, which are a lot more energy efficient to do a separation of our sizing material for the taconite, twice as efficient than the old multi-feed stack sizers we were using. We engage continually in upgrading our motors to the VFD drives, etc. We engage with Minnesota Power on some of these energy projects, and we utilize our common knowledge to identify projects and move our facilities forward, being more and more energy efficient every year.
Mr. Chair?
And members, and Representative Anzalos?
In addition to that very excellent answer, is current law allows the mining companies to receive a rebate on their taconite production taxes annually. And most of these rebates go to capital improvement projects in the mines that extend the life of the mines and are almost always energy related in one way or another.
And members, we have additional testifier that I missed on the list. From Cliffs Natural Resources is here to testify. I want to make sure we hear from you. My apologies if you want to come down. Welcome to the committee, sir. My apologies. It was on the list. I just didn't see it. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, no problem. Good afternoon, Chairman Garofalo and members of the committee. My name is Tulliver Rapp. I'm the Director of Global Energy Procurement for Cliffs Natural Resources. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today of significant importance to our company, the affordability of electric power. By the way of background, Cliffs Natural Resources is a merchant miner and the largest producer of iron ore pellets in North America. We mine low-grade ore and process it into value-added iron ore pellets. These pellets are used to make iron in the integrated blast furnace and ultimately become the high-quality steel used in the production of automobiles, appliances, and a host of other products. Cliffs U.S. iron ore business is comprised of five mining and processing facilities. Two of these facilities are in Michigan. Here in Minnesota, Cliffs manages three operations, Hibbing Taconite, United Taconite, and North Shore Mining Company. Together, Cliffs Minnesota operations can produce up to 19.5 million tons of pellets annually, employ over 1,800 individuals, with a total economic impact of nearly $900 million. Iron ore mining and processing facilities are energy intensive. Energy consumption accounts for 20 to 25% of our operating costs. In 2014, Cliffs combined electric power costs in Minnesota totaled over $145 million. As a result, the mines do proactively reduce energy consumption through energy efficiency projects. However, any increase in rates has a significant impact on the operations, as the mines have no ability to pass electric power costs on to our customers. Historically, industrial electrical rates in Minnesota have been some of the lowest in the Midwest. However, they have been steadily increasing, and at the current trajectory, become some of the highest in the region. It is forecasted that electric rates for our Minnesota mines could increase by 17 to 20% over the next 5 years. From a competitive standpoint, Cliffs Mines in Michigan also have experienced increased periods of electric power costs. However, a Michigan statute allows electric power customers to enter into creative contracts to mitigate costs, which can provide relief through optionality. For example, when Cliffs Michigan Mines experienced rate increases of 110% over a five-year period, the company was able to take advantage of a market-based rate, which halted the continuous climb in electric power costs. Another more recent example in Michigan is when an expected closure of a baseload generating facility in the Upper Peninsula threatened to increase Cliffs' electric bill by $48 million annually. The mines were then able to enter into long-term special contract with our utility partner to ensure fixed rate and a stable rate over the term. These examples illustrate the benefits of making tools available that can mitigate prohibitive rate increases. We believe it is necessary for Minnesota's legislature to amend state law so that utilities have the flexibility to take advantage of creative rate making, which can help keep costs down for job providers in the state. To be clear, we acknowledge the role of the Public Utilities Commission in protecting all ratepayers and do not seek to diminish the PUC's role in approving electric rates. However, we simply ask for the opportunity to propose electric service contracts to balance the manner in which costs are borne across all rate classes. This is an opportunity to preserve the competitiveness of Minnesota's taconite industry, as well as other important industries that rely on affordable, reliable electric power. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today and giving me this time at the end. We also thank Representative Ansels for offering this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, we have six members who wish to ask questions. I'm going to give each member one question, and then we're going to move on to the next agenda item. So Hortman, Metza, then Neuberger. Representative Hortman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ansels, I support the idea of what you're doing very much. In fact, I'm the author of a bill that has an almost identical provision in House File 1315 that the chair of the committee and I are co-authors of. We recognize the need for energy-intensive industry rates. But I'm concerned just about where the iron ore industry is going globally. And so I just have a couple quick questions for U.S. Steel. about the Australia and Brazilian markets and whether we can compete with them on electricity prices or labor costs generally, and then also a question about what the percentage of iron in our ore is compared to what's entering the world market.
To the testifier.
I'll answer the latter first. Our iron ore is approximately 65% Fe content, which is similar to produced pellets in other countries. Some of the Australian and South American mines have the advantage of mining iron units that aren't necessarily pelletized but sent to sintering plants, which is another process feed into a blast furnace feed in other countries. So it isn't always the exact same process. As far as our ability to compete, let me give you an example. Rio Tinto in Australia last year went from over 200 million tons of iron ore production to 300 million last year alone. By the end of 2015, they state that they will increase their iron ore production to 360 million tons. Now, that increase of 60 million tons is greater than the total United States production of iron ore. We're just south of 60 million tons with Cliffs, U.S. Steel, and all the iron ore players in the United States. So that has driven iron ore prices significantly lower. So what that does, it disadvantages our parent company as we try to compete in the global market. Now, those iron ore units aren't necessarily showing up, all of them, on our shores. They're showing up in the cost of Chinese, Asian Rim country to produce steel, which in turn, as I stated before, these state-owned companies, their impetus is not necessarily to make a dollar per ton on their produced steel. It is to employ their people. We don't have the luxury of being subsidized by our government as they do, as they come and park that cheaply, and I will suggest unfairly traded steel on our shores, which we're seeing a great impact of as we sit here today across the American steel industry with the pullback of a lot of the blast furnace production, not only at our company but other companies across the United States, which in turn has backed up our iron ore production because we're just not able to compete with today's cost structure. Like I said, 60 cents on an annual increase from our power supplier, that's over 22 million tons of production. That's $13.2 million on 1 year. That might not sound like a huge figure, but believe me, that's a huge cost for me to pass on to the parent company as we're trying to compete against unfairly traded global steel.
Representative Metza, then Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't ask too many questions. I know the answer to here.
You get one representative.
That's why I was clever, and I decided not to ask a question. I'm going to make more of a statement.
Even better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzels, thanks for bringing this forward. I think it's tough any time when we've been living through our ups and downs, as well as other communities in these types of industries around the country. We know what the boom's like. Just a few years ago, we were sitting and meeting with Mr. Sutherland about an extra nickel for our schools, which U.S. Steel supported. The global market, however, has turned. We're down nearly 50% to where we were. And, we've got to deal with that. There's cost-based rates, which we discussed, which this bill is not. And we knew that our communities weren't as supportive of a cost-based rate structure. This is kind of the beginning of a conversation to try to find a little more stability in terms of the contracts you're entering into for your power agreements with Minnesota Power. And I don't think we can point the finger at any one issue that's driving us to this right now. But for example, this year, 35% of our domestic import, our steel supplied for the domestic market here in the U.S. is coming from imports. That's higher than it's ever been. That's just the first quarter, folks. We are dealing with some companies who would love to break into the American market and take some of the share here with zero regulations in many cases, little kids doing the work. And I see it as our obligation, both to the environment and for good jobs, to see it done right here, where we have the most productive workforce in the world. We produce more tons per man hour than anywhere else, and we're looked to as the global leaders for what we do. We do it the cleanest in the world, hands down, no questions asked. We are good at what we do, and we've been doing it a long time. You know, I think when we're talking about an increase, we're going to see an increase if Keewatin Taconite idles in May as planned, and say it remains to the end of the year. Our ratepayers will see an increase across the Minnesota Power Service territory. So, you know, this is something where we're trying to provide a little bit of stability, and I think it's good. And I appreciate all the community members from the range who came down today. We're with you. You're here today seeing it, so get back home and let everyone know we're trying to do everything we can to help. I think this should be a something that moves forward and continues the discussion. So, again, thank you, Representative Anzels, for bringing this forward. And, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Metzer.
Mr.
Representative
Chair?
Representative Anzels.
If I may, it should not go unstated here that power costs are something that we can do something about in the short term. And one should not conclude that the global economy, the dumping, the unfair trade policies makes this bill not a good idea. Not a good idea in terms of the future. Nothing could be further from the truth because, quite frankly, once the paper mills are gone, once the mines are gone, then truly we are a one-horse economy in northern Minnesota, and tourism simply cannot sustain northern Minnesota as we know it today. So please understand that the global market situation has been with us in cycles before, and we're hoping that it too shall pass, but energy costs are something that we can directly impact, and you can do it this legislative session.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for coming late. I was at a different committee. I had a bill. This goes for the U.S. Steel representative. What, simply put, what is it that's driving your costs of energy up? You saw the charts there, and you projected out through 2019, and MINTAC and KeyTAC were going to be some of the most expensive if that's projected through. What are the drivers of that are pushing the cost of your energy up?
As Minnesota Power continues to upgrade their facilities for more of the green technology, if you will, those costs are passed on to us.
Pretty much
totally to us and not not the consumers.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thanks to the iron ore industry, according to my good friend Tom Rukavina, we won World War II. I like hearing that. Now, the wheat farmers in my area might take exception to that, but you never know. I drove through the Iron Range after a wedding, and I saw all those blue signs up, we support mining, and I just want the miners and the loggers and stuff to know you've got some strong allies and some strong advocates for you here in the legislature. And I do want to make a statement. I think that our migration away from reliable, baseload, affordable electricity has really caused a spike. The farmers in my area are looking at 100% increase in rates in the past few years. But I do have a question for Mr. Grant, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Grant, you still here?
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative David.
Mr. Grant, you're saying this, two things, actually. You said that that you support policies that will lower rates. Can you tell me specifically what policies you and the Dayton administration are supporting that will actually lower rates for all ratepayers in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, the administration has been supportive of reducing rates across the board. That is most commonly seen in the work that we've done in utility rate cases, where we've saved utility ratepayers literally hundreds of millions of dollars over the requested amounts that utilities have come forward with.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up real quickly, he said he supported...
I cut everyone else off at one question, so I got to do the same to you.
Sorry.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just more of a comment than a question. I appreciate Representative Anzell's bill. Having in-laws, my father-in-law used to work at the Mintac mine up in Hibbing, and having some family connections and that,
Let's be geographically correct.
Well, I might have goofed up.
Mintac is in Mount Iron.
Whatever, okay. Whatever it is. Mintac. That's the one he was at.
But thank
Sorry.
You.
Anyway, I wasn't invited. That was a long time ago. So, I think that's, this is taking on a very regional respect, but I think from an agricultural background, which I have, much my family's from, we have a lot of energy, high consumers related to ag industries as well. And it's my hope that, I think your number 7 of that might capture, your section 7 of the bill, capture a lot of those potentially. But, we've got a lot of work to do when it comes to energy and our competitiveness, and I appreciate where this bill's going. And I just encourage the chair to do what we can to make this happen. And, we appreciate, and I will support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Clark, you get the last question.
Thank you. Just a comment before I make the question. The comment is based on the last two speakers. It seems like the lines 122 and 123 might also include agriculture. I don't know. That might be something the author could tell us about later. A question I had for the witness from U.S. Steel was, I read the number here that you give for the overall cost of production, electric costs being 25% to 30%, and I'm just wondering if you have a breakdown of the rest of what those production costs are and the margin of profit. I just didn't hear that in any of the testimony. Maybe I just missed it because I did come a little late.
The test fire.
I don't have that with me, but I can give you a flavor of what it is. It's production taxes, accounts payable spending, repair and maintenance and outage spending. United States Steel has spent $125 million in the last decade on environmental compliance, $77 million of which was in the last 5 years. So the relevance of that, it shows the ramp up we've spent on environmental spending. Of course, wages.
The percentage breakdown for all of those things?
Pardon?
You can give me the percentage breakdown for all of those things?
I don't have that with me.
No, I don't mean today. I mean.
Hold on. Mr. Sutherland, on the other floor. We go through the chair here.
There's some things in the competitive nature of our business that we do not share percentages on. Well, we thought it was relevant to share the percent we engage in our cost of electricity.
So, Mr. Sutherland, you share with the committee what you can, and we'll make sure every member gets that. Thank you very much. Yes. Representative Anzell, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the good questions and your attentiveness to this. This is really about the future of northeastern Minnesota, all of Minnesota, and it's all Minnesotans have a stake in having a healthy, productive, economically viable northeastern Minnesota. We all win, and that's what this legislation is intended to do. So once again, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anzell. With that, Representative Metza once again moves that House File 1782 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much, Representative Anzell, and to all our testifiers.
Thank you.
Department of Commerce, you're up. If we could have our guests please leave, take your conversations to the hallway.
Mr. Chair, while they're trying to leave, I would just like to know.
We're getting the Rangers out, don't worry, Mr. Chair.
We had a please be clear the room and go out to the hallway. You're more than welcome to have conversations in the hallway. We just have additional business before the committee. Representative Horvath.
Mr. Chair, the information passed out by the Minnesota Forest Industries did indicate that Wisconsin's rates are higher than ours, and so, you know, it's easy and tempting to point the fingers at green stuff. Wisconsin has no green stuff, and their rates are higher, so just for the record.
Commissioner Grant, our testifiers, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant again for the Department of Commerce, and I have with me today to my immediate left, Gordon Peach, who's the Director of Transmission and Planning Operations for Great River Energy, and Matt Sugar, who was the consultant to the department who led the study work on this project. In 2013, you might recall that the legislature adopted a requirement for a renewable energy integration and transmission study. The Minnesota utilities and transmission companies, in coordination with MISO, completed this engineering study. Department of Commerce directed the study and appointed and led the technical review committee. The study is an engineering study of increasing the renewable energy standard to 40% by 2030 and to higher proportions thereafter while maintaining system reliability. And the study incorporates and builds upon a great deal of prior study work, some of which has been presented to this committee before in the past. At this point, I'm going to skip going over the schedule that was used for the study in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, and pass the baton to Mr. Sugar, who can walk you through the highlights of the study itself.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Matt Sugar. I'm a consultant to the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So I'd like to pick up with talking briefly about the study scope on slide 4. I want to emphasize that Emirates is an engineering study. It's focused on the reliability impacts of increased variable renewables, wind and solar, and the associated costs of those impacts. The scope for this study was developed from the statutory guidance, from stakeholder input, and then refined by this very robust technical study team. There are really three key components of this study. It's really three studies within one. One was what's called a power flow analysis, looking at how much transmission, how much wire is needed in the state, in the region, to interconnect and deliver these higher levels of renewable energy. The second is what's called a production simulation analysis, which is a modeling effort and a study to look at the dispatch of the power plant in every hour through the year. So looking at on an hourly basis through a full year, how electric energy is consumed in the region, how the existing power plants are dispatched and operated throughout the year, loaded in with these higher levels of variable renewable energy, wind and solar, and their profiles day, night, and seasonal. And looking at how all those pieces fit together to look at whether the system can handle reliably these increased levels of renewable energy throughout the year, and whether the existing system is adequately flexible to meet load in all hours. We also used that second piece of the analysis to look for the most challenging hours of the year and really drill down in those challenging hours, places where the load might be, electric consumption might be low, where the wind or solar might be high, where large thermal plants might be at their minimum dispatch, and look at that in more detail, which we did in the third portion, what's referred to as dynamic analysis, which is saying not only do we want to make sure the system can be reliably operated in all hours of the year, that load matches generation with these much higher levels of renewables, but we want to make sure that if there's some disturbance on the system that it remains stable after that disturbance, that it comes back to a stable point. So with those three pieces of study scope, it was an aggressive schedule for a year, but fortunately we had a very excellent and expert team. You can see on the study team there, it was headed by Jared Al-Helena from Great River Energy, the technical study team, who wasn't able to join us today. Gordon Peach, who is with us, who's with Great River Energy, brought together and engaged all of the Minnesota utilities and transmission companies in this study effort. They worked throughout the year together with folks from our regional system operator, MISO, as well as a local engineering consulting firm, Excel Engineering, that did power flow work, and then technical study participants, again, from all of our utilities throughout the state. We had independent review, technical review on this study from start to finish that included not only the technical experts that I mentioned from our utilities, but also engineering experts from stakeholders, from our national laboratories, Department of Energy. This group reviewed study methods and assumptions and approach, reviewed preliminary analysis and key findings, and this technical group found consensus and agreement in not only the approach and methods of the study, but the results and the key findings. Just very briefly, there are three key scenarios that were studied here. First was a baseline, which looked at the existing renewable requirements in the state and just established the baseline with full implementation out in a year of, we used a study year of 2028 because of modeling, but essentially a proxy year of 2030. Looked at the system operating with full implementation of the renewable energy standard and the solar energy standard. We then took that scenario and incremented the renewables necessary to reach 40% renewable energy for Minnesota by increasing the variable renewables, wind and solar, for scenario one. And then scenario two, we incremented that further for Minnesota to 50%, but also raised the whole region, the whole, all the neighboring states up 10% beyond where they would be otherwise in scenario two. So again, the scenario one focuses on a 40% RES scenario, scenario two, 50% in Minnesota and raising to 25% in the region. I'll skip over siting, can answer questions if folks have that, and we'll move to the power flow analysis. As I described, a conceptual transmission analysis was done. It was led by the Minnesota Utilities and Transmission Companies together with a local consulting firm and reviewed by the full group. The overall finding after some very extensive analysis was that the existing system can largely handle on a transmission basis of 40% with some upgrades, and found a need for upgrading 54 facilities. That's either upgrading the conductor or the wire of the transmission and or transformers with the transmission for a total cost over the 15-year period going forward of about $373 million. And just for context, I will just mention that, you know, in the last 10 years through regional planning that's gone on in the region with Minnesota utilities and with MISO, we've approved and are in the process of building something on the order of about 8 billion transmission in the MISO West area, about 2 billion of that in the CapEx Group 4 projects that were approved and are largely built now. So this $373 million is in context of those larger investments we've already been making. The conceptual transmission found very significant impacts on scenario two, where it was moving to 50% for Minnesota and also moving the whole region 10% higher, and found on order of about $2.5 billion of not only upgrades to existing, but a number of new transmission lines. In that scenario, too.
Quick question for the testifier, and I apologize for interrupting, but under scenario one, it's been a long time since I read this report when it came out, but I thought that that number was different, that 373, and I'm trying to, unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me. Is that the total all-in cost, or was it presented in the report in a different manner?
Mr. Chair, members, the $373 million is the total transmission costs that was found in scenario one. And in the other portions of the analysis, it was found that the system could handle scenario one. So that is a total cost.
Mr. Chairman, your confusion might be, this is looking just at the transmission cost. It is not the cost of the capital associated with building the new renewable system.
Commissioner Grant, but how did the report state it, though? That's why I guess I'm trying to... It says 373?
Yes,
all right, well, it's been a couple of months since I read it, so I could be wrong. It's happened once before.
Got it.
Nothing, huh? Okay, all right. Did you have any concluding comments before we go to members' questions?
I do. I'll step through and just touch on key findings on the final two slides, 13 and 14. The overall finding of this study and this extensive analytical work, the engineering analysis, is that the system can be, for the 40% scenario, the system can be successfully operated in all hours of the year. The system was able to handle the ramping, the day-night turndowns. The transmission was largely able to accommodate it, except for the upgrades that we just discussed, and that there were no dynamic stability concerns in scenario one. Scenario two, similar finding on the operational basis. There's a remarkable amount of flexibility in our Upper Midwest system if there's significant transmission, sufficient transmission to tie it together. We did find in that 50% scenario that significant transmission was needed, and the stability analysis was not yet done for that second case. And with that, I'll conclude, and we would welcome questions.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious to continue on your line of questioning on the ninth slide. The 373 covers the transmission costs. For any of the testifiers, what's the total cost?
For the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, we presented testimony in the Senate on the department's bill regarding the renewable energy standard just last week, so this figure is fresh in my mind. Our analysis is that the cost of the transmission is what was outlined here. The cost of the operating capital costs associated with the upgrades, something on the order of $366 million.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, that's in addition to the 373.
Correct.
Representative Fabian.
And how is that going to be paid for, testifiers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, as all the utility costs are paid for, through charges to customers.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Grant, I want to remind you that in your previous testimony, when you were testifying on Representative Anfeld's bill, you specifically said lower rates, that you favored lowering rates, that you supported. You said that you support policies that will lower rates, not lower the rate of increase, but lower rates. Is this going to lower rates?
Commissioner Grant. Or
Mr. Testifier? Chairman and Representative Fabian, I think it's difficult to say, because if we don't make the investments called for in moving to 40%, then we will make investments in other aspects of the system to maintain it over that same period of time. We don't have a comparable cost associated with that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if it did require a raise in rates, would you mandate a rate increase?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we would not mandate a rate increase. Rate increase requests come from utilities themselves to the Public Utilities Commission, who would decide whether or not a rate increase was warranted.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Dayton administration support the 40 by 30?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, we do. It's in our department bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Follow-up question on the study that was done on the sixth slide, the technical review committee. Can you explain to me why I don't see the Minnesota Rural Electric co-ops as a part of the technical review committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm with Great River Energy. I am a co-op member representing the co-ops. So co-ops were participating in the study through GRE's participation.
Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically to that question, or to that comment, were you operating as a representative of Great River, or were you representing all of the rural electric co-ops in the state of Minnesota?
I was probably representing Great River.
And, sir, if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Gordon Peach, Director of Transmission Planning with Great River Energy.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Then I'll go back to my original comment or my original question. Why were the rural electric co-ops not involved in the technical review committee?
The testifiers.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fabian, to the extent that electric utilities were transmission-owning companies in Minnesota, they were represented on the group.
Representative Fabian?
May I add one?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
If you go to slide number 5, you see the technical study team. There are representatives from various generation transmission co-ops. Maryland Power, Minkota, GRE were all participating.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm well aware of that, but again, I'm going back to why were they not brought to the table in the technical review committee?
So that does first.
I was one of the GNTs. The organization itself was not, no.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question is why?
Chairman, Representative Fabian, I don't know what else to say. We've assembled a large cross-section of the utility companies throughout the state of Minnesota, focusing particularly on those that own transmission facilities in the state of Minnesota. Those are the companies that we work with.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the study is a study of the bulk electric system, of the high voltage system. It is a technical study, an engineering study, and it is not a study of distribution, local distribution systems.
Representative Fabian, is that it?
Hey, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott, Neuberger, Lunan, and Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scherger, is that how you pronounce the name?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Could you state again what company you're with? Or who, I know you consulted for the Department of Commerce, but what company were you with?
The Dustfire.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my consulting firm is Energy Systems Consulting Services.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do they have any other parent company or anything, or you're just a standalone company?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm an independent consultant,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you. And I understand that the study was fairly expensive to do, and part of that would have been, your compensation. Can you tell us what your compensation was for being part of the study? Mr. Scherger. Isn't that public record, Mr. Chair?
I don't know if it is or not, but it's up to the testifier if you want to answer the question or not.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could check to see whether that is, in fact, public information and provide it to the committee if it is.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you. I just wondered, I know that the study cost $750,000. I just wanted to make sure, I just want to kind of know what costs were itemized in there, if possible. I don't have the study right with me, but I do have some notes here, and there were some costs that I was wondering about. Do you have the study with you? Do any of the testifiers have the study with them?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, great. So I have page 4.20. And what costs are covered in the $630 million figure there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're referring to table 4-5, which is scenario 2. It's the transmission mitigations table. So, Mr. Chair, Representative, that $630 million in that table is for the scenario 2 transmission mitigations, and it's particularly for the option of a high voltage DC line. It was a sub-scenario of scenario 2. So that's identifying the mitigations that are associated with that option of scenario 2.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Neuberger and Lunan and Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a quick question for the gentleman from Great River. Just kind of a follow-up here from the earlier discussion. Will any of this, are you looking at a rate increase?
Commissioner and Representative, GRE always looks at opportunity or at rate increases every year. This study is an indicative study of transmission planning associated with the state moving to a 40% As Matt alluded to, it's an indicative study. The transmission that was identified here was based on siting of generation in a study format. Rate increases or any additions to the transmission system be based on the location of generation within the state of Minnesota. So it's very difficult for me to answer that question precisely.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the gentleman, whoever wants to field this one. The GE Energy Consulting, is that a part of GE Energy?
Commissioner Grant.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the primary technical consultants on the study was GE Energy Consulting, and they are a subdivision, an independent company, but a subdivision of GE Energy. Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. GE Energy, are they, it looks like they're a major manufacturer for wind turbines and other renewable or what we call green energy. I just wanted to point that out, that our study was prepared by a major manufacturer of the equipment that we will potentially be buying. So I take some exception to the report here. And also a point of clarification, earlier there was a statement that was made that Wisconsin doesn't contribute renewable energy. The current data that I have as of 2013 here shows that Wisconsin has currently generates 6.9% of its energy from renewable sources.
Okay. Representative Lunin, then Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for the gentleman from the Chamber of Commerce. On this report, with the amount of money spent on it, obviously there's a lot of data. I'm going to ask for your prediction on what effect you think this will have on rate. I'm going off of Representative Fabian's question. I'm asking a little more definitively, asking for you to go on the record with a prediction.
So either the Commissioner Grant or any of the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lunin, as Mr. Sugar attempted a little earlier to put this figure in some context for you, the $373 million, compared to the roughly $8 billion spend on transmission alone, that's not including other aspects of maintaining the electric system. We predict that this has a very, very minor impact on rates overall over the 15-year period.
And which direction would that impact be?
It would be a slight increase, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm new to all this. Well, I'm new to the legislature. And earlier in the our hearing with another topic, they brought up hydro. And on these mandates, I don't see hydroelectricity factored in here at all. Why is that? I would consider that renewable energy.
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lunin, the reason is that we've largely built out the hydro capacity in the state of Minnesota. All of the available good hydro sites have been developed and are currently operating. So there, if we're looking at increasing the renewable energy standard, we wouldn't expect hydro to be at all a significant player in that increase.
Representative Lunin, any follow-up?
Yep, final question. The I've had conversations with different people in my office about some efficiencies, and certainly there's always been a push at the consumer level to do efficiencies to consume less electricity. And now there's an effort out there to create the efficiencies before the meter. And I see mandates on here of where the energy has to be generated from. Has the Commerce Department ever taken a look at any type of mandate that would affect the cost of some of the energy produced, in other words, to compel some of the monopolies, the intrinsic monopolies, to be more efficient all the way up to the front, including transmission?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lunin, we work very actively with all of the utility companies across the state through our conservation improvement program to offer demand-side efficiency programs on behalf of customers, and that's true from the smallest customer to the largest.
Thank you.
And Commissioner, as a general rule, whenever we build new energy infrastructure and we compare it to fully depreciated existing infrastructure, it's going to cost more, regardless of source. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay, so when it comes to looking at the trade-offs with this public policy, this will cost more than the status quo, but it should be looked through the prism of that whenever you build out new infrastructure, fully depreciated assets are always going to be cheaper, just like my parents' housing costs are cheaper because they paid off their mortgage than I haven't. Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chair, that's true, and it's a never-ending cycle. Obviously, the system needs to be invested in order to be to remain operational and reliable, and there are just various paths forward for doing that.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Fabian's question about who will pay for this, I was wondering, when we look at more conventional power sources in Minnesota, such as nuclear, and Xcel's $748 million expenditure on Monticello, which took it out of commission for almost 2 years, who will pay for that $748 million nuclear upgrade?
Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hartman, Xcel's ratepayers will pay for that. And just one point on that, that project added roughly 71 megawatts of additional power, as opposed to the 40% requirement, which would add, by our estimates, something on the order of 2,250 megawatts of new wind if it were all built in wind.
Is that nameplate capacity, or
that's nameplate capacity, Mr. Chairman?
What's the capacity factor of that 2,250?
That's right. They're not directly comparable. Okay. That's
as long as we understand the differences. That's fine. Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to make the point that when we build infrastructure, the same point you made, we pay for it as ratepayers, and we have choices about what kind of infrastructure we're going to build. And when we're adding capacity, we can choose if we're going to add an expensive new coal plant, an expensive new nuke plant, or some expensive new wind and solar. It's all expensive when you're looking at the energy picture. And it's compounded by the fact that in this state, most of our energy infrastructure was built about 50 years ago. It's ending its useful life. And we would be doing extensive investments in transmission and plant rehabilitation, whether we add new kinds of energy or whether we just stick with the same that we've got. And the last point I'd make to Representative Fabian is I didn't say that Wisconsin's not generating any, Representative Neuberger, any renewable energy. They don't have mandates. So if you want to pin Minnesota's electricity prices on our green energy policy, you really can't do that, because when you look around the country and you see who's paying too much, in some cases it's people who suffered from bad deregulation.
And Representative Hartman, the one comment I would correct, although I don't agree with everything you said, is that we can't build new coal-fired power plants in Minnesota anymore. The 111D implementation plan doesn't allow it. So that's the one thing we can't do. I had something else I wanted to say, but I won't. Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In my response to Representative Horton would be, and all of the testifiers, is that, you know, if we truly want to keep costs down, let's just let the market determine it. I mean, when you put in mandates, then that's when you drive the costs up. So.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
They tried that in California, and Enron just basically took money hand over fist from Californians. So the market hasn't proved to operate very effectively in the energy environment.
I think, not that I want to get in the middle of this fight between you two, but I think what Representative Fabian's context was is that if you say, if you're going to set a specific goal to reduce pollution, allow the organizations to determine the most cost-effective way to reduce the most amount of pollution, as opposed to prescribing certain amounts. But maybe Representative Fabian, maybe that's not what you said, Representative Fabian.
Well, and just...
You guys can fight some more. We don't have to adjourn. That's fine. I mean.
It's not necessarily a fight, but, we talked about hydro. I've got three Manitoba Hydro power lines coming, transmission lines coming through my area right now, and there's another one that's being proposed. Plus, Minn Kota provides us with a tremendous amount of hydro. I just think that, you know, with regards to Enron or whoever the other company was, I mean, that's one example out of none. I don't see anything like that happening in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. People here are a little bit too smart, a little bit too shrewd to let something like that happen. So,
but the good news is we all agree that we should not follow California energy policy.
Jackson.
So, Commissioner Grant, any closing comments before we adjourn?
No, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.